Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Another drill. We're recording on Tuesday morning, and I'm looking at just the horrific pictures coming out of Maryland about the collapse of that bridge. But there are two things I want to talk about before I grab my first guest. One is you've heard me get apoplectic about the decision by NBC to hire Rona Romney McDaniel. And I was like, I mean, the stench hadn't even worn off of her as the former RNC chair. I mean, the MAGA stench and the lying stench, because she's a serial liar. But then to see that NBC News apparently was competing with CBS to hire this woman made me crazy. And I started just literally writing everything, talking about Liz Cheney, asking Rachel Maddow to say to NBC, you have a choice, either me or her. So I've been going nuts. But the one thing I did also do is, many of you know, I used to be a fellow at Harvard, and I was at the Institute of Politics. And I want to take you back to 2017, because institutions are constantly failing us. And what institution am I talking about? The Kennedy School. The Kennedy School offered fellowships to Sean Spicer and Corey Lewandowski in 2017. I happened to be there 48 hours after that decision. I went berserk. I went berserk. And then I see this story about NBC. And once again, we are being sold out over and over. But I want to quickly give you what Rachel Maddow said about the hiring of Rona. And so I want to associate myself with all my colleagues, both at MSNBC and NBC News, who have voiced loud and principled objections to our company putting on the payroll someone who hasn't just attacked us as journalists, but someone who is part of an ongoing project to get rid of our system of government. McDaniel's hiring was inexplicable, Maddow went on, comparing it to the member of the mafia working in a district attorney's office or a pickpocket being hired as a TSA screener at the airport. I hope they will reverse this decision. I just wish she would say to them, pick me or her, but you can't have both. And then last but not least, because we cover Texas every week, I saw a really interesting tweet and then a retweet. And the tweet went as follows. In Texas primary runoffs, Governor Greg Abbott and the Club for Growth have raised eight figures to defeat the remaining anti-school freedom Republicans in the State House. CFG says it'll be spending against Vandeveer, Phelan, Holland, Kumbel, and Burns. And this is about the whole idea of Texas, one of the biggest states that didn't have vouchers. And that, of course, has got to be like part of the fabric of being in the MAGA Republican Party. So Greg Abbott has gone to the mat on this whole issue of vouchers. And then a friend of mine retweeted it, and she wrote the following. This is Jennifer Berkshire. Still can't quite wrap my head around the fact that Republicans have made hostility to rural public schools a litmus test, even though schools, one, are the largest local employer, two, hold communities together, and three, towns will die without them. Kind of makes you think, what the heck is their end goal? And so that's my Texas tweet and my Rona tweet. Joining us right now is one of my favorite guests. His name is David Dayan. David Dayan is the executive editor of The American Prospect. He's the author of Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power and Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. He earned the Studs and Ida Turkle Prize. He was the winner of the 2021 Hillman Prize for Excellence in Magazine Journalism. And magazine journalism is defined, I think, by The American Prospect. I've been following American Prospect since its very beginning, just to let you know. And I've been a loyal subscriber. And I will tell you something, David, you've taken it to an incredibly new level. So thank you so much for doing this. But the piece that I want to start with is the piece that you wrote about what happened in New Jersey. And as I mentioned to you, David, I posted two stories on my Facebook page. One was a story of, I believe, January 6th or January 7th, where you see a member of Congress on the floor picking up the broken glass, cleaning up the SHIT that had been left on the floor after the January 6th insurrection. And you could almost get the sense that he was just emotionally drained and angry and frightened by what he saw in a hall that he so revered, okay? And that guy's name was Congressman Andy Kim. Well, it turns out that Congressman Andy Kim also wants to run for the United States Senate. But the story of Andy Kim is really a story of the machine in New Jersey. And your piece was entitled, The Machine Crumbles. Andy Kim has not only pulled off a major upset, he may have transformed the political culture of an entire state. So let me welcome you to the program, David. And my audience knows quite a bit about New Jersey politics because we have Robert Hennelly, who writes for NJ.com all the time. But I think this story of what Andy was able to do in light of who was considered to be the anointed running for the U.S. Senate is an important story. It's not just about the fact that she decided to step away from this U.S. Senate race. It's really the idea that all of a sudden now we've been looking at New Jersey and realizing that on the Democratic side, the definition of the Democratic Party could almost be corruption, because every time you turn around, it was something that you were like, this can't be about an election. I want to take a shower. So explain to my audience a little bit about what has been going on in New Jersey and why what Andy Kim was able to do and the decision of Governor Murphy's wife to step away from this Senate race is so important, not because it may set it up for Andy Kim, but it actually may set it up for actually voters getting a Democratic result, not a machine result.
Yeah, I mean, you have to start, and thank you for the very kind words at the beginning there. You have to start with who holds this seat right now. Robert Menendez is the current sitting senator in New Jersey. He has been indicted. This is his second indictment, by the way, on corruption charges. Among other things, they found gold bars in his house, you know, ferreted away in inside clothing. How does a political culture produce this kind of corruption? That's the first question I think we have to ask. And one of the reasons is that there are legacies from the old political machines in New Jersey. And one of the most prominent parts of that legacy is something called the county line. And what that means is that in every state in America, this is the way that your ballot looks. You have a race for Senate and you have listed all the senators right down the line, right? In New Jersey, they have a county endorsement process. And only if you have a race for Senate, only the endorsed candidate for Senate is in that first column that has all the county endorsees. And if you're not an endorsed candidate for Senate, you are way over to the right and in places that colloquially in New Jersey is called ballot Siberia. And there have been studies about how what the effect is on just ballot placement, on political outcomes. And the study that I've read shows a 38-point difference if you're on the county line versus if you're not. So this is the county bosses, the county Democratic chairs and Republican chairs, I should say, hand-picking who is going to be their candidate. And even though there's a primary, it doesn't mean a whole lot. And so that's the context for how you get to a point where you have a very corrupt kind of political culture, because there is no competition. And if you have someone who's in place who knows that I'm never going to leave as long as I'm the endorsed candidate, that breeds a certain type of corruption. So I think that's the context here, right?
Can I just stop you for a second? Is the county line system basically across the board in New Jersey, or do some counties opt for the county line and some do not? So it's not necessarily that you get all of them, but you get a significant number, maybe some of the more urban ones. And as a result, that's your leverage. That's your edge.
There are 21 counties in New Jersey. 19 of them use the county line. About half of them it awards the endorsement in a process that is basically decided by the county chair, the party boss. The other half, it is decided by a convention, but the biggest counties decide it pretty much by fiat. And so, you know, Menendez gets indicted. Andy Kim is kind of the perfect person for this moment. He jumps in and says, I'm going to run against. Not only am I going to run against Bob Menendez, but I'm going to run on the issue of corruption. And so he jumps in the race. He immediately, you know, gets millions of dollars of grassroots money to participate in this race. And then the governor's wife, Tammy Murphy, who was a Republican for years, she donated to George W. Bush. So it wasn't that long ago. Decides to run. And the day that she decides to run, every major county chair in the state of New Jersey endorses her almost immediately. They do it because a lot of these people who are the county chairs have political jobs that benefit from largesse from the governor. And so it's a really sleazy pay-to-play kind of system where they're endorsing the governor's wife and they're hoping to get favors in return. And they can launch the governor's wife right onto the ballot in that prominent ballot position. So you think at this point, even though public polling shows Andy Kim ahead by like 20 points. You think at this point the race is over. The race is kind of fixed, that Tammy Murphy is going to win this race because she's going to have the prime ballot position in the biggest counties. Well, Kim undergoes a very unique strategy, and he says, I'm going to show the party bosses that I have a major edge over Tammy Murphy. I'm going to do it in those counties where there's a contested convention, where delegates from all over that county come together and they vote. And some of them vote by secret ballot. You know, some of these counties vote with a show of hands so that the party bosses can see exactly who is voting yes and who is voting no. And in those races, Tammy Murphy won. But every single race, except for one, every race with a secret ballot at these conventions, Andy Kim wins, and wins resoundingly, including in Tammy Murphy's home county of Monmouth County. And
sorry.
So his grassroots organizing shows that he has a major advantage with the actual public, even though these are, you know, engaged people. It's far closer to the public than the individual county party boss, right? So he shows this, and he also files a lawsuit to get rid of the county line, saying this is undemocratic, this is unrepresentative, this gives an unfair advantage to the endorsed candidate, even as he's trying to win these endorsements. He's saying, I don't want this county line. I want to abolish it. The fact that he's running this sort of race from a position of ethics, that he's running on corruption, that he's running on, we don't need a backroom deal to decide who our next senator is going to be, he only grows in the polls. In enough of a way, because he won some of these counties and because he's just so far ahead, that he has offset the advantage that Tammy Murphy gets on the county line. Obviously, she saw some polling that shows there's no way I can win this race, even though I'm being given, gifted, really, all of these advantages. And so last week, she drops out. And
unbelievable.
It seems like we knew this was going to happen because the mayor of Jersey City, who's in Hudson County, one of the biggest counties in the state, last week, he had one of those people who on day one endorsed Tammy Murphy. He's the mayor of the county, but he's also running for governor. He's a very powerful politician there, and he's part of the Hudson County machine. And last week, after all the conventions are over, he flips to Andy Kim and he says, I think Tammy Murphy should probably get out of this race. And that was a signal that the machine was cutting bait with Tammy Murphy because they thought it was ruining their big, you know, their fine plan to keep the county line in place and to keep that power over politicians. And so that was the signal. And it seemed like what they were trying to do was lose the battle but win the war. Like, here, Andy Kim, you can win this race, but don't come after our county line. Well, Andy Kim, the day that Tammy Murphy drops out, says, no, I'm still going to pursue the lawsuit. I'm still going to try to get rid of the county line.
I love you, Andy Kim. Keep going.
And I think he's going to be successful in that. And it really shows that he was such the right person for this moment. At a time when people are really cynical about politicians,
yeah.
He produced this persona that was able not only to win this race, but potentially, and we'll see what the outcome of the lawsuit is, but there are other indicators that show he's going to change the political culture in New Jersey.
This story and the second story, they're like Netflix stories. They're such good because he was running about the whole issue of corruption. And corruption wasn't just about the sitting U.S. senator who has said this. And it wasn't just about Tammy Murphy. It was about the political process that was rigged. I hate to say it, a scheme and a rig is corruption. he maybe didn't use that word, but that's exactly what it is. You are corrupting the political process. And that's why with his decision, and I think they actually did think that they were sort of buying him by saying, okay, Tammy's getting out, it's yours, just leave the county line system in, because they want to cling to the machine because the machine is what they know and what it ensures their future wins. And he's like, I don't want to ensure my win. I want to win. but not because of an insurance plan. I want to win. And I'm going to share a really quick story with you, David, because this makes me cry, because people need to understand what the machine means. It's 1991. I'm the first girl, very progressive. I'm going to run for governor. The party leadership hates my guts. They hate my guts. All right. And it is a big event at the Armory. And there's like, you know, 1,000 Democrats there. It's the first time I'm really going to be able to speak to the Democrats in my state. And what does the chair of the Democratic Party do? But he puts all the anointed at the very beginning and he elevates them. And then what does he put me in? He puts me in at noon. And this is what he says before I get onto the stage, all right? Now remember, there's like over 2,000 Democrats in this room. He says to the Democrats, now's a good time to grab a sandwich.
Right.
That's what right. he says as right. I'm about to approach the mic. And mm-hmm. and you see everybody get up to go to lunch. And I am like wild. And here's what I do, David. I go running up. My staff is like, Arnie, calm down. Arnie, calm down. I said, no, you watch. And I grab the microphone. And I said this to everyone in the room. If I see one tush leave a seat, they're going to get a knuckle sandwich. And guess what happened? People started applauding. Everyone sat down. I got a standing ovation. So his attempt to screw me, okay? Right. This is not uncommon. It's not the county line, but it's a variation on putting their mm-hmm. finger on the scale and making their people go first and you go last is not uncommon. And what I love about Andy Kim was that Andy Kim said, it can't just be about me. It's got to be about a future bench for the Democratic Party in my state, because that's ultimately what democracy should be about.
And you see the machine kind of bargaining now to try to save some vestige of this. So there is an active court case. There was a hearing last week. The state attorney general, who is appointed, by the way, by the governor in New Jersey, it's an appointed seat, refused to defend the county line. So the attorney general said, I'm not defending this. We have found it to be unconstitutional. The state legislative leadership then comes out with this statement. And by the way, one of the state legislative leaders, the president of the New Jersey Senate, is also a county chair. He's also a party boss, right? So they come out and say, we've heard you. We want to make tweaks to the county line. We're going to change it. We really think that this job should be in control of the legislature. We think the legislature and not the judiciary should make these changes. That is clear that it's bargaining, like, hey, give it to us. We'll fix it. We're sorry, you know. But they're not going to have that opportunity. The judge is going to rule in this case. Right now, what's on the table is an injunction to stop the county line for this election. This election's in June. And so there's not much time left before they have to print ballots. And so there needs to be a reckoning here in the next couple of weeks. And there are indications that this federal judge, this is a federal case, is going to disallow the county line for the purposes of this election. And so then the legislature would not get the opportunity to make the fixes on their terms. So there are a lot of indicators that this really did change how New Jersey elections are going to be conducted, and really gave a leg up to non-traditional candidates, people who don't rise up through the machine. And so this is really important in terms of Democratic politics and particularly machine politics as the way it's been practiced in New Jersey.
Now, can we do this in New York? Never mind. I mean,
New York, there's not a county line. That's a whole other issue.
I keep thinking about the machine in New York. I only have a few minutes left, but I want to touch on this story, because this is initially why I reached out to you. And it was a story you wrote that was entitled, New Clean Car Rule May Transform Unions in America. And I'm trying to figure out, like, how do these two connect? And then the subtitle is, The EPA Rule Makes It Impossible for Volkswagen to Shut Down Its EV-Producing Plant in Tennessee, which is being targeted by the UAW. So quickly, can you connect the dots about how these two stories actually work in tandem?
Sure. So the UAW announced last week that there's going to be an election. We actually know the dates now. It's going to be April 17th through 19th. There's going to be an election at the VW plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee. That's about 4,000 workers at that plant. Wow. There have been two other attempts to unionize this particular plant. They have both narrowly failed. And one of the reasons they narrowly failed is that there was a lot of fear-mongering, particularly by politicians in Tennessee, who said things like, well, if you unionize this plant, I don't know if we're going to get new business lines in this plant. Maybe they'll shut down the plant. And that's the fear that's created to try to stop workers from, you know, asserting their collective bargaining rights. So in comes this clean cars rule. And what this says is that you have to have a certain amount of fuel economy in your fleet that you sell starting in, I believe, the 2027 model year. And really what it's going to do is perpetuate EVs, electric vehicles or plug-in vehicles, because you can't reach these standards without an EV, right? It's impossible to reach these standards without selling a lot of EVs, as many as half your fleet by the end of the cycle, which would be 2032. Okay, so this Chattanooga facility happens to be the hub of EVs in the US for Volkswagen. The ID4, their only electric vehicle, is sold, is manufactured in Tennessee, in Chattanooga. There is a battery plant right there in the Chattanooga facility. There is a battery engineering center right there in the facility. There is no way that Volkswagen could dismantle all of that and change its logistics, change its shipping all the way to another plant in the United States. It's just not going to happen. That is very impractical. It took 3 or 4 years from the time of announcing this was going to be their EV hub to actually producing a vehicle. And that would be true of any other plant. So this whole argument that officials, whether with the company or outside politicians, this whole argument they make that you can't go union or we're going to shut down the plant, that is impossible at an EV producing plant like the plant for Volkswagen in Chattanooga. So it robs the anti-union side of this key argument they've been making that's been allowed them to cement an anti-union operation in Chattanooga. And so I think this is a real boost to the unionization efforts there. And if you win one race in the South, if the UAW wins this election in the South, it's going to go a long way to unionizing not only other auto plants through the UAW, but potentially a whole host of plants in the South, of workplaces in the South, that will see that this organizing activity that the UAW is putting a lot of money into, $40 million over the next few years, this activity is paying dividends. It's getting results. And so I don't think it's just about this factory, but it could be about unionization across the country and across the South.
What I love about what Sean Fain has done with the UAW is that it's not only about protecting jobs, it's about creating jobs. And they've stepped up in ways that is just so remarkable and so informed. And I just want people to sort of hear this story, because I do think it is the camel's nose under the tent, as they say, because if they're able to do this with this Volkswagen plant, and it makes a difference for the community. The raise in the salaries isn't just for the union workers, it's for everyone around it. Everyone suddenly benefits. You just need to understand that's what this is about. It has a ripple effect. It's like concentric ring theory. You just keep seeing
how
it
they're
expanding,
selling.
Expanding. Oh, I completely, I totally understand it. David Dayan, I am so grateful that you joined us. The two stories that he wrote, the one about New Jersey, yippee, the machine crumbles. It's a story of Andy Kim, who pulled off a major upset. And as you point out, he may have transformed the political culture of an entire state. And then you create the connection between the new clean car rule and what may ultimately transform unions in America, especially in the South. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it, David.
You got it. Thank you.
You're welcome. This, everyone, is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude. We will be right back. Stick around.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. NBC made the right decision in firing Ronna McDaniel. But this whole incident underscores a challenge facing the media, and a way that media, here I'm talking about real media, interested in reporting the truth and having discussions about what is actually occurring in the United States. So we're not talking about right-wing propaganda outlets like Fox News. And I want to be clear here, I'm not making false equivalencies between MSNBC and Fox News. MSNBC, for certain, has an ideological bent, but it's not a propaganda outlet, and it exists in the context of reality. But the challenge facing these networks, whether it's a network like NBC, CBS, ABC, PBS, or a print online platform like the New York Times, is that on the one side, there is this deep ethos about Democrats and Republicans and having some sense of equivalency in the voices that are heard and the numbers of voices that are heard among the people commenting. But there also is the obligation to tell the truth. And when one party, the Republican Party, insists as a principle, a basic principle of their party, of telling things that are deeply untrue about American politics, not least is the big lie about the 2020 election, it puts media outlets in a quandary. NBC wanted to give Ronna McDaniel a platform because they believe they should have Republicans on. But what they realized, too late for my taste, is that the Republican Party is committed to lying over and over and over again, and they are committed to destroying American democracy. And when you platform someone who has been part of that party as recently as a few months ago, you are giving voice to that. And media, real media, should not be in the business of doing that. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Tuesday morning. So I mentioned that this was the kind of the American Prospect Hour. We had David Dayan in the first half. Now we're having Maureen Tasek joining us in the second half hour. She is an investigations editor at The Prospect and a senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project. So I was going through some of the old magazines from the American Prospect. Old, I mean January and February, not exactly that old. And I saw a piece that was posted in January, and I'm like, how did I miss this? And then I started reading the story, and I just got completely enthralled and appalled. Okay, those are the two words I can use. And Maureen, the title of your piece was Moral Bankruptcy, the Constitutional Grant of a Second Chance for the Destitute has become an enabler of reverse wealth discrimination. One wild case in Houston tells the story. And honest to God, I said this to you, I'm gonna say, I said it to David Dan, Listen, someone, if you know anyone at Netflix that's a Netflix producer, I want you to read this story. I want you to go to Business Insider. They've done this story. A number of places have done it. Maureen has done an incredible job at the prospect. After you hear this, and after you learn this, not only are you angry, you will want to take a shower, but you'll want to expose the rot, because that's what this story is. It is about the rot. I am grateful that you did it. And of course, because it sort of originates, or sort of its center of being is Houston, Texas, which is where one of my biggest radio audiences, I was like even more appalled, because I wanted to make sure Houston knew this story if they didn't already know. So let me welcome you to the program, Maureen. And I want you to tell this story about bankruptcy and this bankruptcy judge, and about this guy who does all this sort of persnickety work pro se. He doesn't hire lawyers. He's very smart. He's a Mensa, and my dead husband was a Mensa. So I know everything about their ego and their brains. And I want you to tell the story and how you begin, because the story really is about this guy who's about to proceed because of a bankruptcy proceeding, and he's going to sort of challenge that bankruptcy proceeding pro se without an attorney. And the night before he's supposed to go, he gets a note in the mail. So why don't we begin where you begin, and then we just tumble down into this rot and corruption and story that is so much bigger than him, and yet it really impacts us nationally, because this is the biggest sort of, you know, bankruptcy mill in America, and we need to know about it, because a lot of corporations know about it, and they're screwing you. So let me welcome you to the program and start with the very beginning, because the very beginning really does set the stage, which is why, oh my God, this is a movie. This is a movie. So tell my audience about this fellow named Mike Van Dielen.
Michael Van Dielen is an eccentric gentleman who is very intelligent and has filed a lot of lawsuits in his life. He is not scared of suing to exercise his constitutional rights, and he has sued all manner of individuals and institutions, from JP Morgan, can't really explain that lawsuit, to a bunch of little league officials in Kansas that were rigging games and discriminating against girls in the 90s. I mean, all kinds of things. I'm not going to say that he threatened to sue me throughout the course of reporting this story, but he's not afraid.
But the potential was always there. The potential was there.
So yep. Michael Van Dielen was an investor in an oil and gas company called McDermott. I'm not sure what McDermott's story was, but a lot of oil and gas companies file bankruptcy strategically when, for instance, oil prices fall, or the EPA gives them a big fine, or there's a union that they want to bust, or they get in trouble for contaminating somebody's water, yada yada, you know. Definitely they usually do it when the oil prices are low. They'll file for bankruptcy, wipe out the shareholders, equitize the debt. So they give the new shares to all of their debt holders. They're happy because they know the oil price is going to go through the roof. Everybody's happy, except, of course, retail investors, people who allowed fracking companies to drill in their backyard or on their land or whatever, and never got paid for the lease money. Obviously the EPA, but anyone who's been poisoned by these oil and gas companies, but it's great for management. It's great for the bondholders. So, and usually, whatever the bondholders want is the thing that generally happens in a bankruptcy. So this is one of many strategic oil and gas bankruptcies that I had seen. Now, McDermott is kind of a strange case. They also had they were in big trouble for some joint venture in Colombia where they ripped off the Colombian government to the tune of $4.5 billion, allegedly, $16 million of which was spent on prostitutes alone, allegedly. So McDermott, you know, there's this kind of, and who does McDermott hire to do this bankruptcy for them? They hire the masters of bankruptcy and law in America, a firm called Kirkland & Ellis, which I think last year reported $6.5 billion in revenue. So a really, really powerful and wealthy law firm. And Kirkland & Ellis is sort of the king of bankruptcy law. Van Dielen, not knowing any of this, just knowing that his shares are now worth nothing, filed a securities fraud lawsuit against the company and then against some of its directors. And of course, what happens in bankruptcies, all of those lawsuits are stayed. Generally, the folks who file any lawsuits, any outstanding lawsuits, get nothing. So this has increasingly become, bankruptcy court has increasingly become a really popular place to get rid of any kind of liabilities. And, like you see, oil and gas have been doing it a lot. Before that, it was the asbestos, any company with asbestos liabilities.
W.R. Grace, all those kinds of companies that we can think about in the past. Right.
W.R. Grace. Right. And then of course it goes to Purdue. And then it went to, there's one, pending in Houston right now, a company that made hand sanitizer that was poisonous, contaminated hand sanitizer, you name it. You got a lot of lawsuits on your hands and you could file for bankruptcy and sort of get out of trouble there. And this is the process that got me interested in the story. So Van Dielen, is suing because his shares have been wiped out, and this happens a lot. And you realize that there's certain types of companies, biotech companies, are like this, but I guess oil and gas companies, small pharmaceutical companies, that go bankrupt all the time. And it's just sort of like and private equity owned companies. That's of course the another huge area for this. They go bankrupt all the time, and theoretically, in a bankruptcy, there should be a transparency. There should be a thorough accounting of where the money went and when it went. When were we insolvent, and who's gotten paid since then, and is this all above board? But that actually doesn't end up happening in reality, because the bondholders, what they generally do is they do this thing called they give debtor in possession financing. There's a few different mechanisms that they use, but essentially there usually isn't any sort of thorough accounting. So it is this really insane vehicle for basically legalizing embezzlement. This is the problem that led me to find this story. I wanted to write about this problem because it seemed like bankruptcy court was a great idea, but if student, if you couldn't go there with your student debt. And, there's so many ways in which the bankruptcy process has been closed to individual Americans who was designed for. And yet corporate bankruptcy, those lawyers are billing $2,500 an hour. So this is like, a bonanza. And why are bankruptcy lawyers the highest paid lawyers in America? Think about that. That is because it is a big racket for people who are really good at professional theft. So anyway, let's get back to
I'm just going to read something from your piece. You wrote, "The nation's bankruptcy code has quietly metamorphosed into a vast enabler of reverse wealth distribution." Okay, I just want people to understand. So, we're talking about its potential corruption. And you write, "Bankruptcy is not the only area of law in which public rights have been hijacked by corporations and their legal counsel to serve their interests. Remember, corporations are people, my friend, but given its awesome power to summarily deprive stakeholders of their due process rights, it is probably the most powerful." Quote, "Almost all of law is enforced through civil liability, and bankruptcy supersedes civil liability nobility, notes Lepucky. But the lawlessness celebrity bankruptcy judges have normalized behind the scenes may be due for some law and order. And that's, I mean, that sentence just jumped out at me. And the whole idea that it's turned into this, you know, redistribution of wealth is just gross, because, you know, we have this idea of bankruptcy. And then this story just turns out to be a story that should so outrage so many Americans. And at the same time, it kind of makes you smile with this, you know, pro se guy named Van Dielen, because, you know, he has a history of doing this. But in this case, the fact that he was pro se was probably also to an advantage because of the note that he gets in the mail. So start at where you begin with this message that he gets.
So Van Dielen is, he is being very abused by this bankruptcy judge, this now David Jones. David Jones was, until he resigned, the most prolific bankruptcy judge in America. There were a few years in there where he handled, you know, 30% of the major corporate bankruptcies filed in America, all by himself and his partner in bankruptcy, a guy named Marvin Isger, is sort of, you know, also part of this whole scene. And they set up this complex cases bankruptcy court in 2016. Jones had been extremely abusive and like condescending toward Van Dielen in court. Van Dielen had, you know, and which is, I think, something that, you know, I think that I can see why that might happen. He was very insistent on exercising his rights. And he, you know, described at one point, you know, the high price, to, you know, $2,500 an hour Kirkland & Ellis attorneys just fidgeting and just going absolutely mad while he was in the courtroom trying to, you know, interview certain witnesses for his case. He had had these run-ins with the judge, and he was a very, very persistent guy. And at one point, the judge sort of, you know, got him a little bit rattled in court and said, you know, what are you doing here? Because he called out the judge. Basically, it is against the law to do this too quickly. These bankruptcies that they kind of speed through the system. Everyone who's a creditor should have 30 days to evaluate any, you know, plan and you know, issue their try to appeal or file an adversary proceeding. And like most of the bankruptcies that go through this complex cases court, they were speeding it along. He kind of, you know, calls them out for that at one point and says, well, you know, this is 500 pages. How was I supposed to read this? I just got this last night. And Judge Jones got very testy. And then in the hallway, I suppose, Van Dielen was cornered by a bankruptcy attorney. He didn't know who this guy was. This is a guy named Josh Sussberg, who's a big deal, big shot bankruptcy, big shot at Kirkland & Ellis. His name's on all kinds of bankruptcies. And he, according to Van Dielen, Sussberg told him he was disgusting and started lunging at him in a hallway. And Van Dielen was, you know, confused and rattled and started asking the security guard whether there was any surveillance footage of the hallway. Security guard apparently told him no, but this kind of gets around. The story gets around, and Sussberg moves to have him sanctioned, have this guy Van Dielen sanctioned. They want to get rid of him. They want to oust him from, you know, the court and make sure that he never is allowed in the bankruptcy court again, which is, you know, not legal. But again, you know, the judge basically went along with it. And then Van Dielen, and so it gets around that Judge Jones is having this problem with this pro se. And somebody sends a letter to Judge Jones, an anonymous letter in the mail that says, you might be interested to know that Judge Jones has is having an affair with an attorney, or was having an affair with an attorney at Jackson Walker. Jackson Walker is this Houston firm, which is sort of like the, which plays this role that they call local counsel to Kirkland and Ellis. So Jackson Walker and Kirkland and Ellis go in together on a lot of these bankruptcy cases, even though Kirkland and Ellis has like 80 bankruptcy attorneys in Houston, doesn't really need a local counsel. No one was quite sure, but they had this relationship. They did, you know, dozens and dozens of bankruptcies together. And this anonymous writer says, well, you know, Judge Jones is having an affair with an attorney named Liz Freeman at Jackson and Walker. And she actually was his clerk before she went to Jackson and Walker. And they have a deal with another attorney at Jackson and Walker named Kavanaugh. And it's this whole big feeder system where, you know, Judge Jones promises Kirkland and Ellis and Jackson and Walker that he'll give them a good result and he'll treat their clients really, you know, really well in bankruptcies. And they continue to kind of build up the Houston bankruptcy system. Van Dielen, of course, thought this was very interesting, and he decided to, you know, file an amended complaint containing this letter, and also accusing Jones of, I guess, violating his writ of mandamus, I think, of you know, acting unethically or violating his rights. Long story short, this is true. This turns out to be true. The judge Isger, who is Judge Jones's best friend, claims in court, you know, he gets the corruption case and he says, well, this is all hearsay. Who's, you know, how, if you can't prove this, I don't really know what I can do with this. Judge Jones preemptively somehow gets everything that Van Dielen files in that court. He somehow gets it sort of automatically sealed. So, which is another thing. I mean, again, the crazy sort of, you know, like abuse of the system here is really insane. And Van Dielen sort of, you know, he tries to continue to press the case. They make him out to be a crazy person, which, you know, again, is not that hard because he is a little bit crazy, but no, I didn't say that. He has eccentric.
He's litigious.
He's eccentric and he's really, and you know, he's really an unusual character, but you know, they make up this wild stuff about how he cursed at the judge during, you know, testimony. And he told Susberg in the hallway that he was going to have his way with his wife, which that is the thing that, like, to encounter this man, Van Dielen, it's very difficult to imagine him telling a lawyer, you know, 30 years younger than him, that he's going to have his way with his wife. It's just, you know, that I don't think it happened. They accused him. They sanctioned him on this basis. And then one day, I guess Van Dielen is trying to help a friend with a background search of, you know, a contractor. And he gets this background search software. He looks up Judge Jones and finds out, what do you know? You know, he owns two houses with Liz Freeman, this lawyer. And it was true. The letter was true. Well, as it happens, yes, you know, they have this, there is this very cozy deal involving Jackson Walker, Kirkland and Ellis, this lawyer who had an affair with Jones and clerked for him. And then Isger's other former clerk, this Kavanaugh guy. And they have this sort of, you know, mutually beneficial arrangement going, which is why Kirkland, you know, which is why Kirkland routed, like, you know, I don't know, 75% of their bankruptcy cases to this court, you know, and why Judge Jones is kind of goes from obscurity to overseeing, presiding over, you know, a major chunk of the bankruptcies. I think in 2020, it was half of the bankruptcies, the major corporate bankruptcies in America.
So I'm gonna read from your piece because I want people to just sort of hear a lot of the details. You write, in the first 2 years of the complex case panel, Jones and Isger presided over an impressive 1/5 of all the large public company bankruptcies filed in America. This isn't a Houston story. This isn't just a judge story. This is 1/5 of all the large public company bankruptcies. In December 2018, Isger presided over a reorganization of the oil exploration firm Parker Drilling in just, guess how many days? 22 days. Wow, how fast is that? In 2020, the two judges finished 8 large complex bankruptcies, and you ready? Sit down. In fewer than 45, 5 days. Like, you could even read the material in that amount of time, according to a database. The panel succeeded despite, or maybe because of, the loss of Jones's clerk, Liz Freeman. This is the woman in contention, everyone. And this is why I want you to sort of see, she is sort of like at the center of a lot of this potential corruption. Liz Freeman, who had followed him from their old firm, Porter Hedges. Freeman had taken a partnership at Jackson Walker, a century-old Texas law firm where Isker's old clerk, Matt Kavanaugh, a theater major turned lawyer who worked at Kirkland and Ellis's local counsel on the bankruptcy of Ultra Petroleum, which had made a name for himself. In hindsight, Freeman's career arc seemed, well, full of anomalies is what you use the term, which is what I love, Maureen. No one works as a clerk for 6 years, one attorney pointed out. And she actually been a partner before she'd been a clerk for an almost unthinkable transition. Kavanaugh and Freeman established Jackson Walker as the preferred local counsel of the Houston bankruptcy business, as well as a de facto outgrowth of Kirkland and Ellis. What was not apparent to observers who read the gushing trade publication coverage of the unstoppable new power couple, J.W. and Kirkland, was that Freeman was one half of a different power couple with bankruptcy judge Jones, who, despite describing himself in public appearances as a bachelor who lived alone with three rescue dogs, actually shared $2 million homes with the attorney. It's not clear when Freeman and Jones, who are still married when he was nominated to the bench, became an item, but real estate records show they bought a house together in 2016, the year the complex case panel was established. Oh my God, I'm just reading those two paragraphs and I'm just thinking it's got everything. It's got money, it's got sex, it's got relationships, it's got corporate America, it's got bankruptcies. Maureen, it is unbelievable. But I gotta ask one quick question. How do you create this special panel? How did these judges manage to create within the bankruptcy system a special panel? What gave them the authority? Who did they buy off? What justice allowed them to create this? Because this isn't a private situation. This is a public situation for bankruptcy. And yet they managed to carve out this little exception within the bankruptcy system. And then they end up getting all these major public bankruptcy proceedings appear before them. And it's a slam dunk. It's within 22 days. It's within 45 days. And you and I now both know, as I read your piece, that, you know, everybody was winking and nodding because they knew exactly what the outcome was going to be before they even filed the case.
And that's why Dielen is important, Van Dielen, because there's no one else. I mean, bankruptcy scholars have told me there's nobody else who could have busted this open. This was an open secret. Nobody knew how it was happening, but nobody could question it because he was too important of a judge. So there's really, and nobody can risk, they can't risk it for their career. They can't risk it for their clients. They can't risk, antagonizing a judge. Only Van Dielen could risk that. And he's filed a RICO lawsuit against, Jones and Kirkland and Ellis and a bunch of other, folks as well. So, you know, the plot to be continued, but how it happened is another story.
Some other time, but I just need to know. Now, is the bankruptcy judge still a bankruptcy judge or did he step down?
No, he has resigned. The complex cases panel lives on.
Lives on. And on that note, if you want to go and read an incredible, incredible piece, you're going to go to The American Prospect and you're going to find Maureen's piece. And her piece is entitled Moral Bankruptcy. The constitutional grant of a second chance for the destitute has become an enabler of reverse wealth redistribution. One wild case in Houston tells the story. Thank you so much for doing this, Maureen. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You're welcome. This, everyone, is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You bet.